All right, good morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And every week for the past probably year, I don't know, we have been reading Gary Renard's newest book called The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we're getting along there. We're on page 178 or something now, so no poo, and I just moved away from my bookmark. But anyway, so what's going on with you this week? I missed you last week. All right, Bruce, do I still have you?
Here we go. How's that? I have my microphone on mute. Good morning. There we go. Yeah, we were helping a friend record an all-day workshop last week, so that's why I couldn't make it. So at the usual time, but back again. Looking forward to picking up where we left off on the reading, because I've really been enjoying this for about a year now. I think we probably finish it next few weeks, I think, because we're only got about 40 pages left, I think.
Yeah, I think we are. I think we're going to get there. So we're at the point where in the book where we're talking about politics, which is really kind of really blowing up in our faces right now. It seems like there's a lot of stuff going on in the American government right now that is really wacky. And, you know, I mean, it's been wacky before, and I try to think of times when it wasn't kind of wacky, but you know, and now it just seems like all bets are off. It's like if there's a wacky thing we can do, we're going to do it now and see how far we can push people or how much people will take or how the American public will continue to vote for people who do really wacky things. But it's kind of just only a reflection of my wacky thinking that then I can see it this way. And something that really struck me this past week is, you know, I've been looking at, you know, people post things on Facebook, and my brother-in-law and a lot of my family are very big, you know, Trump supporters, and, you know, posting things about what a great guy he is and what a great job he's doing and everything. And I was looking at that and thinking, how could I have such a different point of view? How could I see this just so completely opposite of the way that they are seeing the world? And you know what? They're doing the same thing about me. They're saying, how can you not think that this is the greatest guy in the world? How can you not be impressed by, you know, how great America is, you know, getting to be now? And I realized that they didn't think America was great before. I realized that, you know, during the Obama years when I was just ecstatic because, you know, it looked like we were making some real progress, they were feeling like I'm feeling right now about Trump. They hated Obama, and they thought he was doing terrible things and causing, you know, wreaking havoc in the world. And so when I looked at that and I thought, you know, this is exactly how, you know, the ego just polarizes us and puts us in a place where, you know, we are not going to see the goodness of one, because we're shadowed over by the thought that we have about them. And it's pretty, you know, mind-blowing when I realize, well, geez, I'm just as wrong as they are. If I... And I'm just as right as they are too, because it is all wacky and none of it has any real meaning. None of it really can do anything to help or harm me, and yet I treat it as if it's the end of the world. Or, you know, it is pretty crazy. Anyway, those are just some thoughts I had.
It's very crazy. And in fact, I think it was yesterday morning, I was inspired to look up a quote from Alice in Wonderland, and I posted it on Facebook, you know, about where was it the the caterpillar or the mad hatter, one of those people. Anyway, Alice says, oh, I don't want to go among mad people. And then the response back from the other Alice in Wonderland character is, well, we're all mad here. You wouldn't have come here if you weren't mad. And I think that's such a great reminder that you know, that this world was designed to be divisive and insane. And it's not like that's never been a factor. It's just that because we have media that now reveals, due to the instantaneous communication that we have, or nearly instantaneous, but we can talk about that in a minute or two. you know, we just have available to us an enormous assortment of, you know, little bits of information that our ancestors didn't have. And they relied on everything from Pony Express to you know, the occasional out-of-town visitor to, you know, get news of the rest of the world kind of thing. And now we can span the globe and get live NASA, you know, satellite feeds and everything else, you know, just did a few clicks and a few taps on our devices. And so it's really, I think, again, the media that we consume is a reflection of our choices in the mind. And those choices really all boil down to one of two thought systems, either inclusion or exclusion. And so, you know, your comments about the whole political situation, about being divisive, it's always been that way. But that's just the nature of the ego-projected world. It's just that we're seeing it more on our face because now there's nothing really, you know, there's not as much, let's say, to you know, have, in other words, there's more opportunities to see the intrinsic polarization of this world, because we have so much media that can convey, the differences that are intrinsic in a world of duality. So, I mean, in a sense, things seem to be getting crazier, and that's certainly, you know, one could say that. And on another sense, it's always been completely insane. And, you know, it's really an opportunity, to look at the contents of our minds and realize, wow, it's always been this way. And now I just have an opportunity to, you know, kick my forgiveness classroom into full speed rather than now and then mode, and realize that every political situation, every relationship situation, whether it's under our own roof or, you know, spanning the globe or anywhere in between, with, you know, one person or billions of people or whatever, or other species or the environment or what we think of as our bodies, our finances, I mean, all those things then become opportunities to look at the battleground that the ego wants us to stay rooted in, and then see how, in contrast to that, A Course in Miracles is saying, I could see peace instead of this.
Exactly. And it's like today's lesson, the hush of heaven holds my heart today, is really all about, you know, I've been in the battleground. I've been, you know, seeing a really crappy world. I've been seeing sickness and all kinds of things. And today, I can just be still. Like that, I can be still a moment and go home. But this one, I can be still and recognize that there is no need that I do anything. Let me just read this. It says, the hush of heaven holds my heart today. Father, how still today. How quietly do all things fall in place. This is the day that has been chosen as the time in which I come to understand the lesson that there is no need that I do anything, right? This right now in all this chaos, this is the time when I've come to know that I don't need to do anything. And he says, in you is every choice already made. In you has every conflict been resolved. In you is everything I hope to find already given me. Your peace is mine. My heart is quiet and my mind at rest. Your love is heaven and your love is mine. The stillness of today will give us hope that we have found the way and traveled far enough along it to a wholly certain goal. Today we will not doubt the end which God himself has promised us. We trust in him and in ourselves, and I love this little pun, in ourself, who still is one with him.
Mm-hmm.
Still, what does still mean?
Mm-hmm. Yet.
It means that yet, still, always.
And not active in the sense of needing to change or changing.
Exactly.
Or being capable of change.
Yeah.
Because the truth of us is truly unchanging and unchangeable. And yet we have identified with the opposite, which only exists in our imagination, but we've given it such, because our minds are so powerful, we've given it such vitality through this imposter thought system called the ego, that we even made up a whole world that reinforces the idea of conflict and battle and divisiveness and differences of opinion. So that's what Gary's going to talk about this morning.
Exactly. So why don't we just go into our reading?
Okay. Yeah. And just to preface it, I was reflecting on, just as one example, some of the events in the last week or so with the Supreme Court appointment and the testimony that came out. And I was thinking, wow, if you look at all the things that circulate through the media and recognize that everything is either a call for love or an expression of love, I mean, it really changes everything. I mean, it doesn't mean that the facts in the physical circumstances are changed. That doesn't go away, but it does mean that we can see everyone as perfectly innocent and let them off the hook in truth when seen through the light of what doesn't change. It doesn't mean that we necessarily change our behavior, although sometimes that can have that awareness can have a very beneficial effect on our behavior. But it does mean that if we can let everyone off the hook in terms of their true identity, then we've let ourselves off the hook in terms of recognizing our true identity as well. So.
Yeah, and you know what? And I think, I'm pretty sure that that's really the only way that we can do that.
Yeah.
There isn't any, there's no shortcut where, I can go and sit up on a mountain and suddenly connect to God. It really has to be that I see the peace and I see the truth and I see the love and I see Christ in everything. That's the only way I'm ever going to have peace.
Yep.
When I come down
yep.
from that mountain, I'm going to see chaos again and I'm going to be unhappy. But if I look at the chaos and I see the truth of what's here, then I can be in stillness and at peace because nothing is wrong. Nothing has gone wrong. So, and you're right that like the Supreme Court thing and then, we're hearing about all this voter suppression and people's ballots being, rigged around and all this kind of stuff. And really it does just look like chaos, but my daughter and I were real fans of Lin-Manuel Miranda that did Hamilton. And, we have the Hamilton soundtrack and we listen to it while we're, putting together puzzles or, whatever. Uh-huh. And, you look back at those days, it was just as crazy. It was mm-hmm. just as wacky.
Sure.
It was total chaos.
The form was different, but the content in the mind is always the same. It's always...
Yeah.
Always can be distilled down to two thought systems.
That's right. Nothing's changed.
It's either chaos or we listen to our inner kindness teacher when we yell uncle. And then that inner kindness teacher becomes the secret agent that helps us transcend duality, right?
Absolutely. So I'm going to let you read.
Okay. All right. We've been reading, again, as Lynn's pointed out at the beginning of our conversation this morning from Gary Renard's fourth book, The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions. And we left off on about the top, I think, the top of page 178, so that's where I'm going to start. And in the midst of a conversation about politics with Gary and his teachers. So Gary says, "That's true. I thought when Obama got elected, it meant a great step forward for America. Finally, we had a black president. And what happened? All these nuts came out of the woodwork. We want our country back," in quotes they'd say. What they meant was they wanted to get back to the 1950s when it was okay to hate people who looked different from you. Quote, "Make America Great Again," unquote, a campaign slogan coined by a deeply disturbed man, really means, quote, "Make America Racist Again," unquote. He even questioned Obama's legitimacy as president, claiming he was born in Kenya. How racist can you get, Artin? Here we go. So Artin says, "So can you make it? Can you not make it real and forgive him?" Okay, there's the
there it is.
There's the billion-dollar question, right? Yeah. And which is our true abundance. I actually, last Sunday, I gave a talk at the local Unity Church up the road in Newport, Oregon, about true abundance. And I think that's where, you know, the grace of forgiveness comes in. I also talked about gratitude and generosity as kind of keys to real abundance. And, but it's really, it's forgiving ourselves for making up a world in which insanity is impossible. And then it doesn't matter the form it takes. The form is just a perfect messenger of the message that says there's something more that I need to forgive. If there's something that irritates us or causes us the least bit of fear or depression or anger or whatever, I mean, that's just basically a gift, you know, on a silver platter that says, oh, you have an opportunity to forgive yourself and free the world in your own mind from the bondage that has been assigned to it by the ego. So.
And when I free the world in my own mind, is the world free?
Well, we're free of our investment in the world. I think that's the critical thing. It doesn't mean that the dream circumstances necessarily change, although I think they do. but that becomes irrelevant. It's basically like when you're solving a mathematical a physics problem or something like that, and you start isolating the variables and find out what's involved and what isn't. Well, on the level of form, you know, ultimately everything affects everything else. But in terms of the metaphysics that we're talking about, anything that has to do with space and time doesn't enter into the equation of reality, which is our eternal nature. And so all those variables that have to do with space and time can be discarded. How simple is
exactly.
that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Or individuality or specialness. Oh, go ahead.
And so we do actually move into a different space and time, mm-hmm. is what it is. It's you actually move into what Jesus calls the real world.
Right. Beyond space and time.
Beyond space and time. And you don't have to take people with you. You know, I don't have to take my husband with me because he's there already.
Right.
You know, I don't have to take Bruce with me because he's there already. I just move into there where I'm seeing, oh, okay, here we are in the land of perfection, not the land of confusion. And now I can see peace instead of what I was seeing before. And in fact, I'm going to forget about all that stuff I saw before because it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And here I am in this world where there is peace. The world actually does change because the world is in our mind.
Exactly. And I think that becomes a really helpful, practical reminder when we're tempted to accuse anyone of anything other than perfect innocence in truth and think that someone outside of us needs to change. Or for that matter, if we think ourselves, you know, we ourselves need to change on the level of form and thinking that our happiness or, you know, as of course, what's our salvation rests on those contingencies. If we can remember, like you just said, Lynn, that we're all already home, that the only thing that's playing hooky is the part of my mind that has decided to invest in a thought system of insanity, and everyone and everything else is already, you know, at perfectly at peace at home, dreaming of exile, you know, but essentially the only one really playing hooky is my mind. When it's on the drug of ego, so to speak, is my mind on drugs, is my mind on ego. And bizarre hallucinatory experience we call space and time, but what we really are is beyond space and time. And that's what this curriculum is. Just patiently, gently, infinitely patiently reminding us that if we really want to be peaceful, this is the requirement. And it's a simple requirement, but it's, not necessarily easy because we've got so much invested in making this world, you know, quote, work for us, knowing full well, like Charlie Brown with his football every year, that, you know, it's going to get pulled away and we're going to go whump on the ground every time we try to make the world work for us. So if we can just gently laugh at our attempts at that, doesn't mean we change what we try to do and what we want to achieve and, you know, ignore our endless to-do lists, but just means that we don't have to take them quite so seriously. Just kind of laugh at, any time we catch ourselves, seeing that there's something in the world that has to be different for me to be at peace, including politicians, including any physical circumstance. So
exactly. And so, yeah, we'll continue reading then, and okay. We'll hear even more about that. Yeah,
I'll go on then. Gary says, "Of course, it's not him. He's just being his toxic-minded ego self. What bothers me is that there's so many people in this country who actually voted for him. That's the hard part. It's sick." And it tells me we're in a sick country. Persa, not totally sick. You're a partly sick country that also has a right mind. And this is a partly sick world that also has a right mind. The Holy Spirit is available to everyone, but eventually everyone will need to forgive all the world. That's because as long as you have conflict in the mind, you know what it leads to. Martin, of course, the ego keeps raising the bar and trying to make it harder for you. The internet, which can be used for wonderful purposes, is also used to spread hatred. And the hatred of the bigots isn't directed only at those with a different skin color. Your country has made much progress in passing laws and achieving court decisions that ban discrimination against the LGBT community. But the hatred is still there. The tragedy of 49 people being murdered in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando serves to highlight what will continue to happen as long as you combine guns and hatred. The ego has set up America very well, and the right wing will continue to make the most of it for their selfish purposes. Gary, I know the Republican state legislatures are always trying to pass laws that discriminate against anyone who isn't a white Republican. Imagine, and this really pisses me off, passing laws that are clearly intended to stop black people from voting. How can they sleep at night? How can they call themselves Americans? How can they dishonor all those who have died for democracy and the right to vote? And how can those who can vote empower these mentally ill local politicians? Persa, that's because on the level of form, bigotry, misogyny, and racism are still alive and well in America and the rest of the world. Even today, women don't get equal pay for equal work and are treated as inferior to men by their corporate bosses. Anybody who isn't a rich white male is, at one time or another in their lives, relegated to the position of second-class citizen. And now you have the immigration issue being raised to the hilt, giving the ego more people to hate. Martin, so let me advise you about something, Gary. Yes, these problems certainly seem to exist in the dream, but there's a fact that comes to you from outside the dream. These problems will not be solved by politics. That's in italics. Yeah, really. What a thought. Yes, eventually they will appear to be solved by politics. Soon enough, white people will not be a majority in America. Hispanics will be the biggest voting group. You don't have to be a genius to figure out where American politics will be going, and it's not to the right. But that's not what will really solve the problems. The only thing that will ever solve these kinds of problems that appear to be in the world will be to fix the problem where it is, in the conflicted, unconscious mind. Gary, well, at least you're consistent. In all the years we've been talking,
he's telling me the same thing over and over. I'm still saying, I don't believe it.
Yeah. Kind of like Jesus says in the course, you know, initially in response to Helen, but really to all of us, you know, do you think maybe the course would work better if you tried it? I'm paraphrasing that greatly, but... I mean, what a concept. Maybe I should give it a try. Okay. In all the years we've been talking with each other and the many different things we've talked about, I noticed that sooner or later you always bring the conversation back around to forgiveness. Yay, forgiveness. It's because that's what undoes the ego. And if you take care of the cause, the effect will take care of itself. And then Art concludes the page with this comment. He says, yes, and for the most part, you've done very well. This political thing of yours is that last general forgiveness opportunity you need to take care of. I say, quote, general, unquote, because it's something that applies to your world in general. You've already forgiven pretty much everything else. Now there are forgiveness lessons that are not general, like the death of a loved one. You've forgiven those kinds of events in your lifetime, too. But you need to be vigilant for God when personal forgiveness opportunities come your way, the kind of opportunities that are not about the world in general. Oh, yes. I think we all have some of those here.
Let's not go into that bag of tricks.
Really? Do you want to pick up from there, Helen?
Sure. Okay. So as we've said, this bears repeating like the whole course does. You'll know for sure that you've forgiven something when it doesn't bother you anymore, when it no longer affects you, when that politician who you can't stand comes on the TV and says something that used to make you go ballistic, and you go to react and there's nothing there, and you feel peaceful instead. You'll know that you've really forgiven him. What a test, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I could see peace instead of this, but I just still want to keep seeing war. But, you know.
So maybe the a slight addition for the both general and specific application could be, you know, the global and the local could be, I could see peace instead of this guy.
Exactly.
Or my interpretation of this person, yeah.
Exactly, and you can do that anytime.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, anytime, but you know what I find for myself, Bruce, is that if I don't do it, it's because I don't want to. If I really want to make that bad guy bad, I really want to make those people wrong. I really want them to see my side, that, you know, what I'm offering or what I think is important is to be, you know, kind to your neighbor and humanitarian to the world. But you know what I'm saying when I say those things? I'm saying, I don't think you are a nice person. You know, I think you voted for this guy, you are evil. You know, I'm putting guilt.
Or at best misguided, maybe?
Yeah, or misguided. Even saying that.
Right.
Is, yeah. You are guilty.
There's an implied deficiency or lack or less than perfect innocence involved, right?
Exactly. And it's the same thing, you know, because I'm a mom, I have kids, and I'm always giving my kids advice about how to be and what to do and what to think and where to go and all that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. I noticed that a large part of that advice is based on the judgment that I have of them, that they are incompetent or they... they don't know
how quickly we forget that as the recipient of those years of advice, we had the same understandings. Like, well, how come my parents don't understand that I'm capable of independent, you know, reaching conclusions independently, you know, something like that.
Exactly, and you've got to trust that you raised them right. Well, you've got to do the same thing with these politicians and these voters. You've just got to trust that they are, you know, they're getting there too, and they are the same thing that you are. We're all the same Holy Son of God. So the, you know, somehow or the other making, you know, them less or less intelligent, which that implies tremendously, is that, you know, these guys are a bunch of dummies. They don't really know what's going on at all. You know, it's all these judgments that are not helpful in any way whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And in fact are quite toxic to our relationships with each other. And so this coming to the conclusion that God knows what he's doing and I don't, that God made this, made me perfect and made my brothers perfect, and they are, you know, obviously not changed from being that thing, even though they act like butts, it doesn't matter. because what they are has not changed. And I think that's the whole basis there, is that when you know that it's worked because you don't want to change them. You don't want to change anything about them. You just want them to be exactly as they are and know that they are exactly where they need to be in perfect harmony with the Christ. And you know, eventually I'll see that, and when I see that, you see that, we all see it. But it's my decision to judge you and to think that you should be doing something different than you're doing, or that you're misguided or mistaken, or whatever my thought is about you, is a judgment that does it completely negates forgiveness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A moment ago when you said perfect harmony, I went off on a little mental tangent imagining a sugar water, and that I think I've pulled my mind back from that. So, one thing that you, when you were talking about sameness and you know, just kind of that whole general topic of, well, it really applies to everything. I did a couple of weeks ago or before, did I mention this video that I happened to see on quantum computing?
No.
Did I talk about that? Oh, I'll have to send you a link. There's a Microsoft video, and I know other companies are doing this kind of research, but quantum computing really is the next, you know, big phase in this world of our technology of, you know, computing capabilities, but it's also communications capabilities. What most people that have studied a little bit of modern physics are aware of is the idea of quantum entanglement, which is basically says that, and this has been, you know, demonstrated in the lab over and over again. So it's just part of the body of knowledge that comprises modern physics or quantum mechanics and that sort of thing. And again, my understanding is very limited, but the example that comes to mind is if you have two electrons that are paired, you change the orientation of the axis of one, kind of like how, you know, the Earth's axis is pointing toward Polaris right now, and another 12,000 years it'll be pointing to, what is it, Vega or one of the other stars, and it keeps, in the precession of the equinox, it kind of spins around like a top in like a 25,000 year cycle, something like that. So where that axis is pointed changes slowly for the planet, but an electron, it can change, you know, gazillion times a second or whatever, I don't know. But it's very, very fast and dynamic because it's now we're down to the realm of the very small. But if you have these two electrons that are paired, if you change the axis of spin of one, and its orientation, the orientation of the other electron's axis of spin will change not at the speed of light, not at 100 times the speed of light, but instantaneously, simultaneously, which is kind of staggering, because what that means is that our notions of space and time are bogus. And now this new technology where they've invented a quantum computing cell, just like a bit is a binary digit, which can be a one or zero in conventional computing technology, which also, by the way, relies on semiconductors that use quantum mechanics, which we wouldn't have had our electronics industry had it not been for, well, we still would have been using vacuum tubes, let's put it that way, if quantum mechanics hadn't come along and totally transformed our technology in the last few decades. But anyway, if you take a quantum computing bit, or a qubit as it's called, you can take two qubits and synchronize them in terms of their data. And this lady on this Microsoft video, which I'll send you the link, Lynn, so you can share it, whatever, showed how she showed a little snippet of the code that is used to program these qubits, and still in a very, you know, pre-infant developmental stage relative to what, you know, we think of as our current technology of conventional computing and digital computers. The name that they use in the software to synchronize the data in these two qubits is called, the command is called teleport. And I thought, that's pretty cool.
Whoa.
A la Star Trek. And what that means is that the data in that one qubit, once it's synchronized or teleported, shall we say, using their language, not mine, the data becomes identical between these two qubits, which means not only are these incredibly fast because, you know, you don't have the, at a quantum level, the speeds are astronomically, or reverse, you know, one over astronomically, whatever the math is, you know, but phenomenally, you know, amazingly fast.
Infinitesimally.
Infinitesimally, tiny intervals of time, compared to, you know, this, the slow moving electrons that just sluggishly move from little semiconductor doped layer to another, you know. Anyway, I took a semiconductor device physics class in college. And that was easily the toughest class I ever had. I was so thrilled to get out of that class with a C minus.
That's crazy. This was
tough material, and it wasn't something that I was, you know, passionate about. So it had a couple things going against me right there. But I was so thrilled. Anyway, long story, but I'll move on. But the whole point of this qubit thing that I think is so fascinating is that now there's a technology that isn't just, you know, on the drawing board. Well, in a sense it is. It's still very pioneering and you know, experimental, but it's working. I mean, they have multiple qubits now that they can synchronize using this technology. And which means that I remember years ago, I'm going to give one practical example from, I think it was Popular Science or one of those Pop Electronics, one of those kind of magazines I remember reading as a kid, you know, several decades ago. And they were talking about, I think it was a Project Sanguine, if I remember right. Yeah, I could probably Google it and find out. It was the Navy's project to figure out a way to communicate with submarines that were deep under the ocean, because radio waves weren't going to get there. So electromagnetic spectrum, you know, anything that they could think of, certainly in the higher frequencies, wasn't going to penetrate, you know, more than just a tiny little layer of water in the ocean. But electromagnetic waves could go at very, very low frequencies and essentially, you know, travel the globe, at super low frequencies, which means you could just have a one or a zero. you know, it wouldn't be a very fast data rate, in other words, because you can't modulate a sub-audible frequency very fast. So it'd just be kind of like really slow information unless they could figure out how to, you know, do something. Anyway, too much information. TMI. but what if you had two qubits, one, you know, in an above ground facility and another in a submarine that had been synchronized through the teleport command, in the software that's running this technology. And so now you take these two qubits that are synchronized, put one in the submarine, and now, hey, just looking at the data in one, you could communicate with the data on the other, you know, if I understand this technology properly. So, but the implications are staggering when you think of
it. It's paired and there's no distance.
Basically, that's it. There's no time and there's no space, in terms of, you know, for all intents and purposes, when you have the two qubits synchronized. Now, the leap that hasn't been made yet, which I'm sure will, you know, be forthcoming, is that this could be generalized to everyone and everything, not just two isolated experimental devices in a laboratory somewhere. Because it really basically says, well, if these two things can be, you know, aligned in such a way that time and space become irrelevant to those two things, why don't we generalize and extrapolate, extend that understanding to everyone and everything? And that basically gives us an opportunity to not only communicate and to compute, if you will, a whole different way of looking at things, not just for specific things, but for everything. And I think that the metaphysics that comes out of that physics is pretty staggering, as well as the physics. So,
yeah. So you know, interestingly enough, I'm just sitting here thinking, so there's a mechanical means that this is being done through. This, I mean, obviously there has to be equipment built and machinery and that kind of thing to make this thing occur. However, on the level of spirit, we're already there.
Right, right.
It's like everything is happening instantaneously, mm-hmm. in reality, in the level of spirit. And this is why, remember when we were reading several chapters back when Gary was talking about having his stuff stolen, his money stolen from his suitcase at the airport, and then having them tell him, well, yeah, but you took that much money from this person, or you did the same thing to this person in another lifetime. And when they said that, I had this image in my mind of Gary in another lifetime reaching into his suitcase in this lifetime, because it's all happening instantaneously, and taking that money and and recognizing that it didn't happen in the past. It happened right that very instant. It's happening right now in this very instant. And that's really, that's the truth of we don't need to find a mechanism to make this happen.
Right.
That is the truth of what's happening right now. Yeah. And the only thing that we need to do is to recognize that. And the only way that we're going to recognize that is to stop thinking that the world has to be something different.
Mm-hmm.
And stop concentrating on what your experience is in the world, recognizing that it's just an experience, just like any other experience, just like, you know, Hamilton, and just like the election, and all these things are just experiences that are all happening at once and having no effect whatsoever. And I can move from this experience of fear or upset or sickness or whatever to the space of complete and total peace and health, because it's the same place. You know, that's what this quantum physics thing is saying too. It's in the same place.
Right, right.
It may appear to be distant in time and space, but really it's just in this very instant.
Yeah, John Wheeler, a well-known physicist who in the quantum mechanics, modern physics realm, said there's no out there. And that kind of,
yeah,
it kind of, you know, says it all, doesn't it? That we really are so accustomed to the linear distorted view of space and time, thinking that, you know, we have all these dimensions and yeah, that's one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at it is collapse the dimensionality of everything to zero, which is basically saying that the tiny mad idea never happened. And then, from that perspective, everything happens all at once. We do hold the hush of heaven in our heart today. We do have perfect innocence now, and so does everyone, because the dream was over long ago. You know, relative to the eternity that is our real being, all these quantum tools are just basically mechanisms by which we are returning our mind to the awareness that it truly never left, except in a bizarre and silly and ultimately forgivable dream.
Exactly.
So the trick is to, instead of making the forgiveness ultimate in a far off sense, is to, you know, speed up the process a little bit by, you know, becoming more mindful and vigilant and generalizing and saying, wow, well, I forgave that. You know, that wasn't a big deal. I found I could let go of now that I'm, you know, in my few decades later, I can forgive some things that happened in my, you know, youth and teenage years and thereafter. Now that I look back on it, you know, why can't I apply that to what's going on now? Well, why not?
Why not? Yeah, why not? Yeah. That's your problem, your choice.
Mm-hmm.
You figure that out. And, you know, if you recognize there is no reason, then there is no reason.
Yeah.
And how can you hold up that argument? How can you continue an argument when you recognize there's no point to it?
Exactly. What could you not accept if you knew that everything was gently planned by one whose purpose is your only good, you know?
Exactly. And Jim is saying on the board, which dream might be partly real? Or as I've heard him say before, which part of this illusion do you want to keep? You want to make it
what,
real.
What part of total insanity But part of this world is totally insane as we interpret it as egos. Don't we do we not want to understand?
Right. And then part of what we want to keep, you know.
Yeah.
Of course I want to keep those evil people out there doing those evil things so that I can remain thinking that I'm good, but I really know that if I don't forgive it, I'm not really good, and so I'm really evil too, and oh my God, what am I doing to myself?
Once we hit the teleport command in our own minds and are quantum entangled with everyone, then it's like, well, okay, there's nobody out there, as John Wheeler said, there's no out there, so there's nobody out there that's doing anything to me, it's just a decision in my mind that I made. Then we look at, well, why would I have done that? Well, because I had an unconscious, and now it's unfounded when we recognize that by listening to Holy Spirit's counsel and letting that wisdom inform us that nothing happened in truth. Our innocence is complete, and we are all perfect spirit, unaffected by anything that's happened in a dream, and therefore we can afford to be extremely, infinitely patient and gentle with ourselves and everyone, and let go of our white-knuckled grip on trying to change the dream and see peace instead of the this of the ego's this.
Exactly. And, you know, I just was thinking as you were saying that, I was thinking about that scenario with Gary, with them having taken the money out of the suitcase, mm-hmm. and thinking, you know, I know he got on the airplane and he was happy he had that money, and all the way home on the airplane he was thinking of, you know, whatever good thing he could do with that money. He was completely happy and satisfied and thinking that everything was cool till he got home and then realized that that money was gone. What changed? He the money was gone the whole time he was on the airplane. The money was gone the whole time. Yep. And the only thing that changed was his seeing of this thing. And so that's what it is. The only thing that changes is our ability to see it. And once we recognize that I could see peace instead of this, it does absolutely change things. Oh, thank you for sending me that link.
Yeah, I just put that in the chat window for the Skype conversation. Yeah.
So let's go on and read. We have about 13 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And you want to read, Parissa?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, so let me back up that paragraph. Just get the context again. As we've said, and this bears repeating like the whole course does, you'll know for sure that you've forgiven something when it doesn't bother you anymore, when it no longer affects you. When the politician you can't stand comes on TV and says something that used to make you go ballistic, and you go to react, and there's nothing there, and you feel peaceful instead, you'll know that you've really forgiven him or her. Or whoever, or whatever. Persa, remember to monitor yourself and apply the steps you know when it comes to the things that still get to you. One, notice you're being activated in a negative way. That's the ego. Stop thinking or feeling with the ego. Stop making it real. And that's where the Bob Newhart therapy comes in, right? Just stop it. Two, start thinking with the Holy Spirit. That's the holy instant. The Holy Spirit reminds you it's not real. This is a dream, and it can't affect you without your belief in it. You're not a victim. This is your dream, and it can't hurt you. Three, engage in spiritual sight. That person isn't a body. They are perfect spirit, but not part of it. Rather, they are all of it, totally innocent, and exactly the same as God. Do you remember the Course quote that says, release my son? And just a quick aside, since they were sort of recapitulating the three steps of forgiveness, I always like to give myself a mnemonic of reveal, release, and replace. Reveal is the revealing to ourselves, recognizing that the ego isn't working. Release is when we let go of the ego, and then we automatically start thinking with the Holy Spirit. And the third stage is the replace, and that's just after we've gotten out of the way, our you know, erroneous illusory thinking is replaced automatically by the spiritual sight, the true vision of the Christ within us all that sees everyone is completely innocent and all of spirit, as I just said. So Gary says, sure, just before the last chapter, can you, to whom God says, quote, release my son, unquote. Be tempted not to listen when you learn that it is for you. It is you for whom he asks release. And what but this is what the Course would teach. And what but this is there for you to learn. Yeah, the sole responsibility is to accept the atonement for myself with a capital S self, right? Because if I accept it in my decision-making mind, I've accepted it for the entire sonship, right?
Exactly, and that's the perfect thing. And that's what we have to understand, is that what we're doing here is not just accepting it for ourselves. We're accepting it for everyone. Mm-hmm. And since we accept it for everyone, then we can, this is going to sound really crazy, we can assume that they've accepted it for themselves.
Right.
And whether they have or not, whether that's evident or not, whether they're still acting like a butthead or not, doesn't matter. That's what Jesus talks about with true charity. It is looking at your brother and seeing him as being far beyond where he appears to be right now. Seeing him being in the truth. Seeing him representing the Christ. This is true charity. And when we offer that charity of looking beyond what he appears to be doing and seeing that he is whole, and as they told him much earlier, you are the Christ, a whole, healed, and forgiven, all is forgotten and released, that's really what it's all about, is you look at them as being whole, and then you recognize they're helpless to change their behavior. They're helpless to change the political situation. They're helpless to change anything in the world because they're just like you. we can only patch things up or do things in bits and pieces, but we can't really unmake the world in any other way than by practicing forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. When you said the word "you" a moment ago, Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's one of the most challenging, but ultimately rewarding and fulfilling ideas in the Course, and one that Ken Wapnick does such a great job of reminding us at every turn, is that the Course is not addressed to the Bruces and Lynns and whoever's listening of the world. It's addressed to the decision-making mind that seems to be hiding within the personas of the Bruces and Lynns and whoever else is listening to this. Because that basically makes all the difference, because the decision-making faculty that is our true being, the truly the Christ being that we all are, have, and share, is already home. But because we still have this decision-making faculty that chooses either for or against ego, we still have, some work to do to let go of the residual issues that, again, are our only dream attachments and investments in surreality that we need to, at our own pace, let go of. So we don't need to change anyone else. And if we think we do, then we're just, back at the bottom rung of the ladder in the victimhood dumpster again, and need to start climbing back out, instead of hiring the interior decorator for the dumpster. Pulling out all my favorite metaphors here.
Deep in the dumpster. I just saw a video the other day of a guy people rescuing animals, and here were these three little possums in the bottom of a dumpster, and they had crawled in, but they couldn't get out. And so the guy came along and he put a ladder down there, or a board down there, so they could climb out. Uh-huh. And that's really what it is,
Yeah.
We're in the bottom of the dumpster, but there's a board there.
And that's a great metaphor. I for years I always thought, the difference between empathy and sympathy, sympathy being ego's version, is you see someone in a hole, crying for help, and you dive in with a shovel, and whereas empathy is say, oh, hey, I've got this rope ladder here. Let me tie it to this tree and throw the other end down to her. I've got things I need to do, but you can crawl out anytime you want now. That kind of thing, right?
Exactly.
And, oh, by the way, that rope ladder's been there all along. It's just, you didn't notice it, and I didn't notice it. And by me noticing it, now we're both off the hook, right?
Exactly. And so that makes them also responsible for their own whatever it is that they decide or not to do. But I can't condemn them if they want to stay in the bottom of the dumpster. Maybe there's still some food down there they like. Maybe there's something, you know, I have no idea.
Oh, but, a moldy pizza crust. Ooh, I'm going for it.
But if I drag them out of there, I can't force a person, and no one can force another to accept help or accept the atonement. All I can do is do that for myself and trust that you will do it too. Trust that you are perfectly capable of accepting the atonement for yourself. And it's not my business to decide when. It's not my business to decide how. Not my business to decide where you get, you know, any part of your journey. Yeah. So, you know, mind your own business. Stay in your own stuff. Take care of your own thing. and trust that your brother is perfectly capable of doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all safe at home dreaming of dumpster exile, and it's all pretty silly, huh?
It is pretty silly. All right. So,
do you want to pick up where Arden jumps in again?
Sure.
You have it?
She's saying, remember the course quote that says, "Release my son." And I'm just going to read this. Gary says, "Sure." Just before the last chapter, quote, "Can you, to whom God says, 'Release my son,' be tempted not to listen when you learn that it is for you? It is you for whom he asks release? And what but this is what this course should teach? And what but this is there for you to learn?" And that's it. Release my son. That's it. And what else is there? So Arden says, there you have it. So let's talk about another important subject. You know that according to the course, all pain is caused by unconscious guilt. Did you ever stop to think that your experience of death will be different depending on how much guilt in your mind has been healed by forgiveness and how much still remains? Gary, I never thought of that, but then why should I? Just kidding. I never thought your experience would vary depending on forgiveness, but it makes sense. So he's saying he never thought his experience would change depending on forgiveness, but it makes sense. And I know, and you know, that our experiences do change by practicing forgiveness. So Arden says, in most cases, and I would say most, but not all, because the ego likes things to be complicated, when your body stops, you don't feel any pain. You may feel pain as you die, but not after. Just the opposite. Usually it's a really good experience. No physical pain. The relief of appearing to leave the body and being free is a beatific experience for most at first. And I think that's where Eckhart Tolle said it was like taking off a too tight shoe. Mm-hmm. Is how it feels. I don't know how he knows that, but it seems it makes
he
sense.
May have worn really tight shoes. So
he may have worn really tight shoes.
a foot reincarceration experience, maybe, huh?
Let us not incarcerate our feet. Okay, so Arden says, and we just have another minute, so I don't know if I can, let me just get through this. In most cases, and I say most, but not all, because the ego likes things to be complicated, when your body stops, you don't feel any pain. Oh, I just read that. Gary says, you know, I've been thinking about that a little lately. I remember how much I cried, next page, at how upset I was when my mom and dad passed away. We didn't call it making your transition back in the 70s. They died. My father was on the job, and he just fell dead, his body going to the ground. When I heard the news from the doctor on the phone, it was like a nightmare. My poor father, I thought. I figured it must have been very painful and horrible for him. But thinking about it now, I realize, first of all, that he passed away quickly. Second, that he probably wasn't feeling any pain from the instant he passed away. The pain probably ceased immediately, right? Well, yeah, of course, because it's the body. Arden, that's correct. So there you are. There you were, devastated and crying, and here he was having a good time. I assure you that when both of your parents made their transition, from the instant it happened, it was a wonderful experience for them. And that's true no matter how horrible a death a person may appear to go through. Say something, someone gets shot in the head. Anybody who sees it or hears about it, especially those closest to the person, is horrified. But what they don't understand is that the person goes immediately into an experience that is fantastic. As the Song of Prayer section of the Course says, we call it death, but it is liberty. And I think that's going to end our time this morning. And I'm going to put a bookmark here. And thank you, Bruce.
And while you're doing that, since we're on that subject, if we could just, if I could just look this up very quickly, there is, and for anybody in the Denver area, I've been attending an online class on Tuesday and Thursday mornings that Lynn Corona and Tim Wise are doing. And just wonderful. It's a class, but there's also a lot of discussion. And this is part of their School for A Course in Miracles curriculum. And they just basically offer it to any course students that are interested on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. They're starting a new one on Saturday mornings as well I've suggested donation. Not that the other ones don't. But anyway, on October 27th, Fearless Dying from A Course Perspective is an all-day workshop for those in the Denver area that Lynn Corona and Tim Wise are doing. And if anybody's the least bit interested in that, whether they're going through that kind of experience with family members or friends or whatever, or just, you know, interested in the subject, I'm sure they're going to do a fabulous job with it. Lynn's son passed on this past year, so it's been kind of an up topic for her. And the things that she and Tim both have shared in that regard over the last few months have just been very profound and inspiring about how, you know, this is not our real identity. So there's nothing lost in letting go of an identification with the body. So anyway, so thank you again, Lynn, as always. And I'm reachable on ACIM blog, and looking forward to our next conversation.
All right. Thank you, Bruce, and I'll talk to you next Saturday.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks, all.
All right. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.